Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Glenn Pringle, and this is the Barebow Archery Podcast.
Today's show is all about target panic and 3D archery. So if you ever thought of trying 3D, stick around and see what you can learn. Our guest is Dwight Dorsey. He's the 2019 IBO National Triple Crown Champion. Dwight talks about discipline in shooting, the shot process, and what helped him manage his target panic. He also talks about shooting against the top IBO 3D competitors, Dwayne Martin, John Demmer, and Mark Lind. Dwight references Bob Rotella, a leading sports psychologist, author of books such as How Champions Think and Life is Not a Game of Perfect. If you want to know more, have a Google for that. On future episodes, we delve into the world of sports psychology and the mindset of a good shot. Good luck to all barebow competitors this weekend. You've got the Italian Indoor Championships in Rimini, the French Indoor Championships, Archery Northern Ireland Indoor Championships at the Lisbon City Archery Club, the Battle of Basing in Hampshire, England, which is one of England's biggest indoor shoots, the Utena Cup in Lithuania, and finally, the 2020 Stockholm Spielen in Sweden. Shoot straight, everyone, and remember, have some fun. So on the line, we've got Dwight Dorsey. How are you, Dwight?
I'm fine, Glenn. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. What's the weather like
there?
Nice
to speak with you. It's actually very nice. I'm in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania right now, and it's about 52 degrees Fahrenheit, and it's... I'd say sunny, maybe a little clouds, but it's very nice.
Cool. And did you visit
Liverpool?
This? Oh, I'm up in a place called Newcastle, which is right up just before the Scottish border, and we're on the east coast, so we don't get the benefit of the Gulf Stream really here. So
I see.
Yeah, we're always a little bit colder, but a little bit drier because the island, we've got Ireland and the Lake District in the way, and that takes all of the rain for us, which is really good.
Colder
but drier. So yeah, it's been nice today, but we've had winds 40, 50, 60 miles an hour for weeks now. So every evening. I mean, I was sending messages to Joel Turner at like 2 a.m., 3 a.m. this morning because I was woken up by bits of the house blowing about and bits of stuff blowing about in the street. His response was, "Get your bow out and go and practice some concentration."
Practice some real distraction.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, "Well, I don't think the neighbours would be too impressed." There's about eight of them within 100 feet of my little range. So, 3 a.m. in the morning, even with the 60-mile-an-hour winds, I don't think they would be impressed.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. Dwight, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started in archery, what you do, where you live, what archery's like, where you, and what kind of clubs you shoot at, what kind of game of archery do you do?
Sure, okay. I live just outside of Baltimore, Maryland, just a little bit outside of the Beltway freeway that runs around it. I've lived there for about 26 years. I grew up in central Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, and I actually got started shooting a bow when I was a really little kid. When I was about 4 or 5, I got one of those, you know, toy bows with the suction cups.
Oh, yeah, my daughter's got one. Yeah, my daughter's got one right now.
My dad was in the Army Reserves, and he had a footlocker, one of the old wooden footlockers, and I would flip the lid up. This is what, you know, he designed this idea for me to shoot, and we'd stuck what looks like a kind of a feta target to it, and I would shoot it till I wore out all the suction cups, and then I think I sharpened the points of the wood arrows, and I went outside and shot it into things until I was probably out of arrows. But then when we had moved, and I was about 7 years old, my dad came home from his what was called summer camp when he was in the National Guard. And they used to go to Grayling, Michigan, which is where Bear Archery was. And he knew that I liked shooting the bow. So he brought me home what's called a little bear recurve, I think it was called. And it pulled about 16 or 18 pounds, but I just was in love. I was enamored with that.
Awesome.
So then through the years, I shot some different recurve bows when I was a kid. It's probably still my fondest memory of it, anything I've done in archery, is to go out in the backyard with my stepdad. My mom had remarried when I was about 15. And we used to go out in the backyard and shoot into straw bales, and we would just do it for hours on end. I don't think, you know, I didn't know anything about form. I just shot instinctively, but boy, it was fun. It was a blast. Then after that, I shot compound for a while. Again, I didn't compete, but I had a hunting bow. I had one of the really old style ones for a while. And then a buddy of mine wanted to go deer hunting in Ohio one year, and so I bought a used Martin compound bow, and I just learned to shoot fingers like that, and did that off and on for a few years. And then sort of fast forward to today, I joined a place, and this is where I shoot. There's a place called Baltimore Bowman. Some people, if they're in the U.S., we'll know it. If they're into traditional archery, we have a big 3D shoot every May where we put out about 90 or 100 Reinhardt targets, and it's just a fun shoot. But
sounds
we get
cool.
A big crowd. We get 1,000, maybe 1,500 people come to that.
Wow, that's good. Cool.
So I joined that club. It's very, very close to my house, and I still had a compound when I joined, but there are a lot of traditional archers there. And so I joined, and I was lucky enough. The first two guys I met at the club are still really good friends of mine, Ron Broadwater and Glenn Latubnikus. They both shot a clicker on their bow at the time, and I had unfortunately discovered a few years back with my compound bow that I had target panic, and I didn't know what to do about it.
Okay.
And I met these fellows, and I call Ron the clicker whisperer, because he knows how to set up a clicker any way you want it and make it as quiet as you want, so you can either just feel it or just hear it. And he's hunted with one for years. So they helped set me up with I just took my old Ben Pearson recurve bow and put one on and learned to shoot. You know, the instructions on the Cricut clicker say, I think it says something to the effect of, no matter what, don't shoot until it clicks. And so I just, for some reason, that sunk into my brain, and I didn't. I shot that way most all the time. Every once in a while, I try to take a break and find something else that would work. But I shot with a clicker for about 10 years.
Okay.
And in that 10 years, I think I probably only let go of 3 arrows that it didn't click.
That's good going. Good going.
Yeah, and I... And it really was sort of a saving grace for me, because when I picked up a recurve bow, even though I was still just aiming instinctively, if I knew I was going to shoot at something, even if it was only 7 yards away, I couldn't come within 2 or 3 inches of anchoring to my face. I would just lock up.
Right.
So it was really a huge help to me.
So moving on from the clicker, did you go from shooting the trad bow with the clicker to then trying bare bow, or did you shoot that with a clicker, or what rules were you shooting? Was that IBO or NFAA or something like that?
Right. Well, I did. I shot with a clicker and had just sort of resigned myself to the idea that this is how I shoot. And I could shoot the Lancaster Archery Classic. At that time, they still allowed a limb-mounted clicker, and they allowed up to a 12-inch stabilizer.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the same rules that the IBO, the International Bowhunting Organization, allowed in a class that they call recurve unaided.
Right, okay.
And I guess the unaided meant no sight. But... So I was comfortable with the idea that I could do that if I wanted to compete. And the first thing I competed at was the Lancaster Classic. Just missed, I think I missed the cut by one my first year, but I was sort of, you know, I was, it's nerve wracking, but I thought, well, I can do this. And then, I didn't shoot any IBO 3D competitions really until about, I tried it one time at the IBO Traditional Worlds down in Nashville in 2016, but it was one of my times where I thought, okay, I'm going to figure a way around this clicker. And I was using the feather touching the tip of my nose as a trigger.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Which works, but it's much more subtle than a clicker or a real trigger of sorts. And I was, because of where the arrow had to be anchored to do that, I was shooting what I call it gap stinctive. It's like an instinctive, but you see where the arrow is pointed, but I can't tell you the gap.
Okay. Okay. That's cool. Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of people that tell me that that's kind of the way they shoot, but I tried that in Tennessee and I got close. I missed making the finals by one or two positions, I guess, because I had missed two targets in 2 days. And then from there, I still shot the Lancaster Classic with the clicker. In 2017, I still shot IBO with the clicker. The only two tournaments I shot in IBO were, I went to the Pennsylvania State Championship because even though I live in Maryland, it was closer for
me.
Yeah. And it was actually at a nicer facility, better setup. So I went there and I qualified, which is actually pretty easy. IBO, I think, says you need to finish in the top 20 in your class at a state shoot or a world qualifier to go to the Worlds. Well, traditional archery doesn't draw that many people to a state shoot, so I easily, you know, qualified. And then I went and shot Worlds at a place called Seven Springs, which is a ski resort in Pennsylvania.
Okay, yeah.
And was lucky enough, I was very nervous, but I was lucky enough, I finished third that year.
That's good going. Good going.
Yeah, I got to meet, I got to shoot with John Demmer, which I think everybody that's listening to this, if they know Bear Bow, knows John Demmer or knows who he is.
Yeah, if you don't know who John Demmer is, then you don't know anything about Bear Bow.
Right, you're on the wrong podcast.
Yeah, you're on the wrong podcast on the wrong planet, because he is he is like a talisman for Bear Bow. He's brought so many people into it.
Yeah, I think John is maybe, I mean, if you look at all the disciplines he enters, he might be, he's certainly in the top two or three, if not maybe the best all-around Bear Bow shooter in the world. I don't know. He's close, but he's very, again, you know who he is if you've watched anything. But I got to shoot with him in the finals. He was in a group, the next group next to us, shooting the first 2 days of qualification at Seven Springs. And then I also got to shoot with a guy who's now one of my closest buddies, a guy named Corey Gulvis, that I don't think as many people know, but he actually won Worlds that year. He beat John.
I remember Corey from a Push podcast episode.
Yes, he was. If you listen to the Push podcast that features Dwayne Martin, the first 30 minutes of it is them talking to Corey right after he had won the IBO Worlds.
Yeah, and I remember that one. Yeah.
If you listen to that, I mean, you've heard Corey just like he is. That's just who he is. He is about as humble as anybody you'd ever meet. But when he is on, he is something to behold. He is an unbelievable 3D shooter.
Is that your main game then, 3D? Is that
it is. I think probably for a couple reasons. One is the club, Baltimore Bowman, where I shoot, we're mainly a 3D club. When I first joined there, we still had a full field course set up, but we suffered a lot of vandalism from neighboring properties, and some of our target butts or bosses we just couldn't maintain, and we just didn't have very many people that wanted to shoot field. But we have a pretty good number of guys that always want to shoot 3D, and for members we always have 3Ds that are, you know, they're sort of the worn shot up ones, but they repair the targets and we keep them out in the woods, so you can go out and shoot 3Ds pretty much any time. Some of them aren't, you know, some of them, they don't have, they've been repaired. They don't really have scoring rings on them, on them anymore. But some of them are in really good shape. They're all Reinhardts.
Cool.
And, so I do that, and I'm lucky that that club is only 4 miles from my house. So
yeah,
it's like
great.
People talk about shooting in their backyard. I live in an apartment. I don't have a backyard, but Baltimore Bowman is my backyard. So I have about 70 acres of woods with 3D targets. So I like that. I started shooting that with my buddies there, and then I enjoy the idea. It's, I used to play a lot of golf.
Okay.
You know, you go around a golf course in a threesome or a foursome with people you know or people you just met, and you joke around and you can, you know, you play golf. Well, this is kind of like golf with bow and arrow. You get paired with some people. You're going through some nice, most of the time, pretty nice wooded or meadows, and you're really only. The other thing I think I like about it is in the IBO discipline, it's an unmarked yardage 3D.
Yeah.
I think, isn't World Archery is that way, correct?
Yep. In 3D, World Archery is two rounds of 24, two arrows at each target, and it's all unmarked. And it's for barebow. I don't know what the other yardages are for the other disciplines, but barebow,
I think it's 30 meters.
Yeah, 5 to 30. Sometimes you don't get a lot at 5. Some courses, they just stretch it out and everything's 20 plus.
Right.
Other courses, we shot the UK 3D Nationals in Scotland, and they had maybe 3 targets at about 5, 6 meters, but you were literally 90 degrees to the target. You were shooting straight down into it. It would only be something the size of a small rabbit. Your kill zone would be, you know, the size of a coin. So
right,
yeah,
like a quarter or half dollar.
Yeah.
Well, that's similar to IBO, only in IBO, for people that haven't shot that form of 3D, it's one target or one arrow per target. For the barebow type class, or what used, this year they changed the name from recurve unaided to barebow.
Okay.
It's supposed to be a 30 yard maximum. Me and a lot of other people always thought that the allowable fudge factor was 10%, so it could be a 33 yard shot, and which is 30 meters. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yes.
You would see that fairly often. The few years that I've done it, until last year, I didn't see very many short shots at all. Almost nothing under, say, 17 yards.
Okay.
Last year, I saw some that were under 5 meters, and some that were 10.
The thing with the shorter shots is a lot of people don't practice them. So as soon as they come across them, they think in their brain, well, this must be easy. But they've no experience of it, and they kind of, a lot of people who seem very confident when they go into the 5 meter, 6 meter shot, come away with not that many points, or not as many points as they expected.
I know what you mean. Last year I sort of shot the first half of the year with a fixed crawl, where I picked out a mark on my Yoast tab that gave me a 27 yard point on, and then I just adjusted my point up or down, sort of like a gap shooter would do.
Yeah.
Well, at truly close yardages, you know, I could, and they didn't give us really very many small targets like they have in World Archery. I mean, the smallest target we see at IBO is like a little bobcat size thing, or a turkey. The kill zone on a turkey is very small, but I was shooting at traditional worlds last year, and John Demmer was one of the few 3Ds that he shot, or at least a few IBOs. And we had some close targets, and he was saying to another guy that we were paired with, Joe Fleener, who's an excellent shooter, after we got through a few of the very close ones, he said, he was telling Joe, but I think, you know, everybody was soaking this up. He said, That's why you need to have a 15-yard crawl, a 10-yard crawl, and a 5-yard crawl, because the top guys are going to hit X ring, which is 11 in IBO. So they're going to hit 11s virtually every time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I took that to heart. I practiced that for the next tournament, which was a regular IBO Worlds, and it helped.
Can we just go into what you've kind of been involved in terms of IBO? So July 2019, the Triple Crown. So is that three different events and then it's a cumulative score? You came number one at that one?
Right. What the Triple Crown is they have three different shoots in different locations that they call the legs of the Triple Crown or jewels of the Triple Crown, sort of based on American horse racing, I think, the name. But so there's one in May, one in mid-May, one in mid-June, one in mid-July. So if you are the overall high score when you add up the three events, then you are considered the National Triple Crown winner. And last year was the first time that I decided I wanted to try it, because it's a little bit of travel. I mean, the furthest event away was about a 12-hour drive. But I know people that are my archery heroes have won it. You know, the Dwayne Martins of the world, the Mark Lins, people like that.
That's so good. That's good company to be in.
Yeah. And I told myself and I told my buddies that my goal last year was I really want to win a buckle, because the IBO, if you win either the National Triple Crown or the IBO Worlds or Trad Worlds, if you win it, you get this really cool cowboy buckle looking thing that says, you know, you're either World Champ or National Triple Crown Champ.
I've seen a picture of it, and it is a very nice thing. We don't get anything
really
like that.
Nice.
Yeah, we've got
they're
nothing
silver
like
plated.
That.
They're heavy. I know, you know, Corey won one in 2017, and he's so humble. He still has it in a box on his desk. He won't wear it. But I told him he's a better man than me, because I would wear mine if I won one.
Me too.
So anyway, I went to the Triple Crown events, and the first one I went to, I shot well, and I did well enough to win that one by 3 points. Shot with a buddy of mine, Jeremy Stout. We had a really good contest, and I just clipped him by 3 points, and I was surprised that I beat Dwayne Martin by a few points.
And Dwayne's a good competitor, isn't he? He's a strong-minded, strong-willed competitor.
He very much is. Now, Dwayne is – he very much – you know, make sure that everybody is playing by the rules, which everybody should do. He is one of my favorite people to shoot with, because Dwayne is a competitor, but he's also very funny. Dwayne is, I don't know, he'll just make these little quips that I get, you know, and I think a lot of people get, but they're funny. I shot with him actually at the second leg of the Triple Crown. He and I had texted each other, and we were planning to shoot together. We were going to be in a group, I think about five of us. And I saw him at the practice range, and I said, "Hey, buddy." And he said, "I'm not your buddy today." he said, "I'm tired of trying to beat your brains out today, so we're not buddies until we're done." Now, most of that's tongue-in-cheek, but a little bit of it's true, because he knew he had some shooting to do to catch me. And he did. He beat me by 10 points that day. He shot 367 to my 357. And then when you get to the final leg of the Triple Crown, the top five or top 10 people, they do something they call peer groups, where they want to make sure you're shooting against the guys that you're close to in score.
Yeah, yeah.
So myself and Dwayne Martin and Joe Fleener were the top three in the running. So we all shot together. And I was lucky enough. I had one of my best days ever shooting. I really sort of went into it nervous, thinking that Dwayne was, I think he was 19 points behind me, but I thought, boy, he can make that up in a hurry. I've seen him shoot 380 something on 40 targets. And I just had one of my best locked in days. And you were asking me, this past year, I transitioned from using a clicker to using something people who have listened to or know anything about Joel Turner are really familiar with, which is some type of a SEER system.
What I
transitioned to, and this is actually why I first listened to your podcast with Martin Otteson, because he mentioned that same thing, which I didn't know he used. I found it fascinating, and I found some similarities in what he said he did, but I'd been doing it since I think September 2018 was when I first started trying it.
Yeah.
And
I'm in the mind.
Corey Galvis has been trying it, and Eric Yost has been doing either a tab seer or grip seer, but I use it without, I don't modify anything on my bow.
Yeah.
I found that the Win and Win riser has a little radius on the very front of the riser. It's a rounded edge, and it's smooth, and I can pop my ring finger fingernail off of it as long as I keep it trimmed fairly short. I can make it a very good trigger. So that's what I used all last year, and I shot the best scores I've ever shot in IBO. So
was that
thank you, Joel Turner, for the system.
Was that a conscious decision to kind of go down that route? I mean, you could have tried saying, oh, well, I can't shoot the limited clicker in these classes anymore, or, you know, if the rules change or things like that, and you kind of say, oh, well, I'll try it and I'll go without the clicker. And I think if you've been on it a long time, it's probably quite a hard transition.
The first thing that made me try, I mean, over the years, I've tried a few things, you know, if anybody that's had target panic has spent hours and hours and thousands of arrows trying something like, okay, maybe it's this today. And, you know, usually you go home frustrated. But I want to say it was for the 2018 Lancaster Classic, they changed the rules to be strictly World Archery barebow.
Yeah.
And John Wirt, a good friend of mine, one of the great people in barebow archery or archery, great guy.
Yep, great ambassador.
He told me probably 4 or 5 months ahead of time, he said, you're not going to like me, Dwight, but we took away the clicker. And so I said, well, I'll figure something out. So I think I shot that first year using feather touching my nose or something like that. But part of it was after having found out that I could do that, I started talking to Eric Yost, is a good friend of mine. He had been sort of messing around with a tab seer, and my good friend Corey was also using tab seer and was having good results.
Can you just explain the tab seer for us? Because it might be a difficult concept for people who've never seen one before. And I remember I first looked at what is a seer. I tried Google searching, couldn't find it anywhere. And eventually somebody said, this is what it is. And I was like, oh, it's that simple. But for the uninitiated.
It's almost too simple. But
yeah,
like if you know a little bit about like the inner workings of a firearm, the trigger mechanism has two metal surfaces that are against each other, and there's just a slight bit of overlap of the metal or engagement, and when you put pressure on it, it pops off. And when it pops off, in that case, it fires a gun. Well, in the case of like, and I've shot the tab seer too. What I did is, again, I didn't modify it. I used my thumbnail. Once I would come to full draw, I would start with my thumbnail sitting in the groove at the edge of a Yost tab, that little border groove, if you're familiar with their tabs.
I've seen the tab.
I would get to full draw. I would get to pretty much my aim, and then I would actually pop my fingernail forward out of it, almost like a set trigger on a rifle. Like, okay, now all I have to do is move that same amount rearward, and it's right next to my right ear. It would make a little click. It was, you know, just the tiniest. Nobody else could hear it. You could just hear it in your ear. And for me, having shot the clicker for so long, that audible click was very workable.
Yeah.
The thing that I found for me with the tab seer is it was very finicky. Your thumbnail length trying to keep it at a length that works is very difficult. Some people, I guess, don't, you know, do something like that and it doesn't vary as much for them or it doesn't bother them. For me, it did. So one day I would go out and try to shoot with tabs here and I literally could not get it to pop at all. Or I found that I had started pressing and I didn't even realize that it had already popped into the groove. And that got, that was actually last winter that started happening a lot. So I thought, well, I'm going to try using my fingernail on the front of the riser. And that, for me, is much more consistent as far as it works. I can't say it's more accurate. I think the tabs here is really accurate because it's not, you're not doing anything to your front hand that could disturb your arrow.
Yeah, yeah.
But the for me, the grips here, A, I can keep my fingernail trimmed pretty short, and it works. It works really well. And I can sort of concentrate on using light pressure. You know, I can have that as a mindset when I first draw the bow, just very light pressure on that. And I sometimes find it's almost, it almost pops off too quickly. Some days, you know, it's a struggle to get it to go. But interesting, fingernail length still means kind of a lot. And I was telling, it's funny, I was telling this story to Corey, and he said, well, you need to make sure that you tell Glenn this. when I, and he's the person that told me about your podcast. So.
Oh, cool. Thank you, Corey.
Yeah, yeah. When I went to the regular Worlds this year for IBO, even though I'd had a successful year, I had won the Triple Crown. I had placed second at Trad Worlds right behind John Demmer. I actually beat him the first day, which is a feather in my cap. I've never beaten him at anything.
Woohoo!
Yeah. And then he put on a phenomenal show on Sunday. Oh, yeah, it was amazing. He shot a 297 with a dozen X's on 30 targets.
Wow.
And won. But hey, if you're going to lose to somebody, you may as well lose to one of the best.
Exactly. So. Yeah. No shame there.
No shame, no. So I went to Worlds, and for one reason or another, I had very little confidence. I got paired up with guys, and I shot the first day, and I had a miss, kind of a collapse, which just hadn't happened to me in, I don't know, months or years. And I kind of did what, if you've listened to Joel, where he talks about, all right, you have to make a decision.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that. He was telling me to make a decision last night.
Yeah, and I said, all right, the decision is after that miss, you are going to clean up your act. You're going to shoot your shot the way it's supposed to be shot, the rest of the targets, or you're just going to go home. And so I finished out, I think, with 5 10 rings in a row. And for the day, I was sitting third. I was 8 points behind guy named Lenny Mayle, who I'd never met. He's a really nice guy who was shooting great, and Joe Fleener again, who was only a point behind him. And I felt I was really lucky to only be 8 points back when I shot what I thought was a terrible score. I shot 168 for 20 targets, because at regular Worlds you shoot 20 targets one day, you shoot 20 the next day, and if you're in the top 5 scores in your class, then you go shoot 10 targets with the other people in the top 5 the final day. So I went out to the practice butts, and I was, you know, working on my confidence, working on my making a decision. But I carry with me in a little pouch, I've got one of these metal Revlon nail files. And I actually worked on that ring fingernail until I just file it down a little bit and shoot, file it down a little bit and shoot. And I got it perfect. I mean, it was like a compounder with a back tension release that all of a sudden the pressure is perfect.
That's good preparation. That is preparing to win, basically.
Yeah. So I was just all of a sudden stacking arrows. And so we went out on Saturday to shoot the second round. And I don't know if I've ever been that confident. I shot I shot a 193 for 20 targets.
Wow.
I went from 8 points down to 14 points ahead.
Cool.
And it was, I mean, it's the greatest single day of shooting I've ever had. It was, regular worlds are famous for very hard courses, and it was a very hard course. And I don't know how, I still don't know how I did it, but it was fun. And then just, I shot sort of my average on the final day and was able to win. So,
well, but 3D seems to be your game. I mean, you've done over the, just having a little bit of quick Google research. I could be wrong on some of these, but you know, you've podiumed in IBO World since 2017. You took third.
Right.
You've done IBO Pennsylvania States, number ones. So 3D seems to be your game. And going over from the tab clicker to the grips here doesn't seem to have hurt you in any way. It seems to have, you know, got better. I mean, can you explain the kind of the concept and why you do this? Because you'd mentioned target panic to me before and in our kind of offline conversation. How does that help you? What is your process? What does the trigger do to kind of get you over that? Because I'm in that kind of boat at the minute. I've gone that kind of couple of years where, you know, you start out and you kind of middling along a little bit, and then you have a real spurt of kind of a real acceleration in your kind of progress. And then you plateau a little bit, and then you slip down.
And Martin, yeah, I have those.
Martin was saying to me that it's where you go from that point, because people just disappear because they think, I can't get over this. But there are obviously ways people get through it. What keeps you kind of going? How did it work for you? How did it manifest itself for you? And what do you do? What is your process?
Okay. Well, like I said, the first thing I did to try to get some control was a clicker, a limb mounted clicker. And people say, you'll even hear people say, oh, it cures target panic. I personally, I don't know if I've ever met anyone that I think has had target panic cured, but I tell people I've found a way to shoot with it. I've had target panic for 23 years.
Wow.
But if I could take, because to me, I'm one of, maybe a common thing, like if I shoot with no, not trying to use any kind of sear or trigger mechanism at all, I can aim on target briefly, and then I get the, you know, little flinches where it wants to let the arrow go.
Yeah, been there,
Sometimes I double clutch, and then it's a really awful looking shot. Sometimes it doesn't look too bad, but it's very quick. You know, if you're standing off the side, you'd think I was a snap shooter. So what any sort of a sear, be it tab sear, a clicker, or the grip sear does for me is allows me to come to, you know, full draw, anchor, a solid aim, and maintain that aim until something else that I really can't control the timing of subconsciously triggers me to shoot. It's the exact same process as an Olympic bow clicker.
Yeah.
If anybody's ever shot that. There it's, you know, you pull, 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 or expand, whatever your little mantra is. I do have a mantra, and I took it directly from Joel, not from directly speaking with him, but I think from one of his videos or one of his printed words of when I take my stance and I'm at the stake or I'm at the shooting line, I've looked at my target, and say if it's 3D, I've assessed what I think the yardage is. Let's say I think it's 27 yards. So I will run my string walk on my tab down to the mark for 27 yards. I'll get my grip on the string. I will put my hand in the bow on the grip for pressure to give a little, just to start to pull the draw. And then my draw cycle looks a little like if you've watched John Demmer, it looks a little like his, in that I'm drawing and raising the bow at the same time.
Okay.
But when I first get that crawl mark and I'm ready to go, I I look at a specific spot on my top limb and I say to myself, controlled process shooting. Sometimes I say it even softly out loud, but it's, I have to start the shot with that. I don't know why this works. Joel could tell us why it works, I guess. But something about doing the same three actual spoken steps each time, the brains and the nervous system seems to like. So I say that little bit. I say control process shooting. I draw the bow and I get locked in to the aim where I want. I feel like I'm at full draw. I've got my aim set with the top of my arrow point on roughly the middle of a 10 ring of a target. Even though I can't see the 10 ring, I know where, since I look through the binoculars, I know where it's located. Once I've got that, and there's nothing left to do but actually try to run my sear, and I actually engage my fingernail after I'm at aim. I move it up to the front of the riser. I think it's just because of the way my hand fits on the grip. Joel says I should do it beforehand, but it seems to work this way for me.
Is that kind of a safety then? Because you've kind of got to that
point.
Yes,
if I haven't put my finger up there, I could shoot the bow, but I don't. I would never let go of the string.
Yeah.
Almost like a safety on a release mechanism.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like clicking the safety off. Now I've put my finger up there, and if I add a little pressure to that ring finger and it slips rearward and makes a little, it's just a felt thump of my finger. It might make a slight bit of noise, but I can't hear it over the bow going off. It's almost the same time. But so when I get that point where the only thing that I need to do is run that little sear mechanism, I say, here I go. It's what Joel calls the here I go moment. Okay, now I've separated my shot. Everything that came before was set up. When I say here I go, the only thing left to do is watch my aim. I can't say I'm still aiming hard, but watch it and focus on my sear movement, which I usually just say, I try to keep a very calm under my breath or inside my head. I say, keep pressing, keep pressing, keep pressing. And within usually 2 to 5 seconds, it pops.
Okay.
And when it pops, most times the arrow's gone. Something I've noticed over the years, it was odd, even with a clicker, and this is, for some reason, I had the ability to overrule it. Like, if I was shooting with a clicker and it was a really windy day, and right as it clicked, the wind blew me off target, I could hold the arrow. I don't know why. I still seem to be able to do that even with a grip sear. Like, say I went ahead and started the process a little earlier than I should have. I really wasn't locked on my sight picture, and it pops. Most of the time, I don't shoot, so it's odd. It's like a permission to shoot, but it doesn't make me absolutely have to shoot.
So your
but
brain,
what I do,
your brain's
it's the
there
same
saying,
instant.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's even though it's a permission to, it is, if I am going to shoot that arrow, it's at the exact instant that fingernail pops off the riser.
Yeah, I mean, I remember somebody telling me that, oh no, the clicker's there, it's just a draw check. And I was like, well, I've watched a fair number of these kind of World Archery Finals. I've never seen any competitor hold that string for half a second, a second, 2 seconds after the clicker's gone off.
Right. Yeah, I've never seen an Olympic shooter do that. And there's a guy that sent me, he used to post on Archery Talk all the time. I haven't been on there in a long time. But actually, I'd seen this under, I think, guys on some sort of Australian archery website. Posted a thing about the origin of the clicker.
Oh, yeah.
A man in Cincinnati, have you ever seen it? A man in Cincinnati, Ohio, invented it in the late 50s. And he did it because his whole family had gotten into archery, and within 2 years, two or three of them had very bad target panic. And
yep, I've read. I think I've read the article about his son. Yeah, I think it was his son.
Yeah, his son wrote it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This guy was smart enough to realize that the problem was is that you were the sight picture was causing the release.
Yeah.
And he wanted to invent something that took away your sight picture's ability to release the arrow. So, and then evidently he, I guess Earl Hoyt Jr. saw it somewhere and asked him if he had a patent, and he said no, and he wouldn't mind. He didn't mind if Hoyt, you know, produced them and used them. So within a couple of years, virtually all the Olympic shooters were using it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm currently reading, I think it's Jay Kidwell's book that Martin...
Instinctive Archery Insights, I think it's called.
Yeah, because I'm trying to, for some bizarre reason that I don't really need to know, I'm trying to figure out what the actual psychological mechanism... Jay is a PhD in psychology, and he says it's classical conditioning. It's Pavlov's dog. You've trained yourself to see the 10 ring, you know, the 12 ring, your goal is, that's where the arrow's supposed to go. And then through repetition, you've practiced on sight of that stimulus, then you let the arrow go. And people get to a point where they're drive-by shooting, so it's coming up from the bottom and they're kind of coming through it, or going from the top, sides, left and right, or they can't get on the target. So I'm trying to understand what the kind of mental process is, what's going on in the brain. He advocates, you know, doing kind of holding drills.
And I've done some of them where you... he advocates coming at the goal or at the target from different angles to make it so it's not the same all the time. I tried those, and maybe I didn't stick with them long enough, but it worked some, but I found that I was frustrated by the idea that I was going to have to do it all the time, day before I shot arrows.
Yeah.
maybe that means I'm not dedicated enough. I don't know, but.
It's a big commitment if you're going to do it.
I've done the bridge programs. I've shot.
Oh, tell me about that. Tell me about the bridge program.
Well, there's a guy, to my knowledge, it was come up with, and maybe it was somebody before him. There's a guy from New Jersey named Lynn Cardinale. And he came up with an idea that you start, you know, it's like blank bail. I think you start maybe even blind bail. You get up to you're close one step away and you're shooting eyes closed to get the feel and hold as long as you want. And then you can open your eyes and shoot. And then the bridge program is you make roughly, and I mean, people that know it better will probably correct me at some point, but you're basically making yourself a bullseye that there's no way you could miss. Like it's a big black dot as big as a trash can lid or bigger.
Okay.
And you start up there, you know, one step or two steps. And all you're trying to do is aim in that and shoot a controlled shot. And the bridge program is you work for X number of days at a yardage, and then you're allowed to step back a yard, and then you do the same. And you keep moving back while keeping this giant bullseye for at least for a long period of time. But the crux of it was, as soon as you have an uncontrolled shot, then you have to move back up to the closest distance again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I was one of these people, my target panic was bad enough that it wasn't just around people, it wasn't just at a shoot, it wasn't at a distance. My target panic, I could not hold the string anywhere near as long as I wanted to at one step away from a blank bale.
Okay.
Within 1.5 seconds, it was going to go. And I just, you know, I watch people like John Dimmer or Grayson Partlow or somebody that holds with this nice steady aim for 2 to 5 seconds and then just this beautiful release. It just wasn't happening. So that's, you know, I sought out different things.
Yeah.
I'm not that young. I'm 58. So I thought I may not have
the time to get this
five years to do holding drills before I can actually shoot a tournament.
I mean, that sounds horrible anyway, doesn't it? Five years of not
it
shooting
does.
Anything.
it'd be like, I used to fish a lot. It'd be like if they told me I had to practice casting for 2 years before I got to go well, fishing.
That sounds,
lose interest.
It sounds like being a member of the kind of Olympic recurve team. I hear similar things where, you know, somebody's come up through the ranks and they've performed and performed and eventually they've been picked up by a national squad. And as soon as they get to kind of training camp where they live kind of residentially almost, the bow's put away, you know, take the limbs off it, stick it under your bed. You're not going to see that for 6 months. And they just train with a stretch band for 3 months.
I've heard those same stories.
Yeah.
And that's dedication.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's probably, you know, maybe Brady Ellison from the U.S., maybe the, when he first met Kissick Lee, maybe that's what he did then. I have read things that say that the Korean team trains that way from when they're very young. They don't get a bow for 6 months or a year. They have to learn how to proper stance, proper alignment before they ever get a bow. And then they just progress. Then they don't get arrows, and then they go from there. Obviously, the proof's in the pudding. The Korean women just own everything in recurve archery, it seems.
My daughter's just about, she's eight. She's just about to start shooting, and I really don't want her to shoot at a target. I don't want her to get that association. I want her to think about, well, how did that shot feel? Did that shot feel good? Did the arrow fly? Was the arrow flight nice? Just things like that. More kind of fundamental. The hitting the gold or hitting whatever she's aiming at, that'll come in the future. But I think right from the start, especially with the courses here in the UK, you're shooting at a target. I'm just going back to what you were saying about the kind of the big, you know, the big bullseye, as it were. You know, you're there and you know, you can only progress once you've got through a clean round of, you know, aiming drills. I remember seeing a similar thing. I think the guy's on YouTube. He's called Chris Hill, Olympic archer, I think, on YouTube. And that was the same.
Okay,
he
I
was like,
I've seen that one.
He was doing the same kind of thing. He had a series of targets, a 122, an 80, a 60, a 40. And he was like, you know, you aim at this big target until there's no urge anymore. And then you move up to the next target. Just because the stimulus itself is getting smaller and you're getting more and more comfortable with the kind of, whether you do a figure of eight. I don't do a figure of eight. I literally do up and down vertically. And then at one point it stops. And unfortunately, that's my stimulus to shoot. And that's when other things...
Right when it stops.
Yeah. That's it stops and I'm thinking, has it stopped? Okay. And then that's my stimulus to shoot. But I'm usually in the wrong frame of mind at that point. And when you were going back to your, was it controlled?
Control process shooting?
Control process
shooting,
yeah.
That phrase?
Yeah, that's, when you were saying that, I was thinking, this sounds like you kind of, you get yourself into a constant mental state on every shot. You say that to yourself and you've got this kind of mantra, it's a little script, and you go through your process. And it's constant, it's repeatable. And I think my problems, and I think, you know, some of the other people that I see, their problems are they don't... Martin was talking about no process shooting or just shooting with hope, no plan shooting. A lot of beginners are kind of... I know I was. It was just like, you know, I lifted the bow. I didn't think about lifting the bow or where my bow arm was or anything. It was just like lift the bow, come to anchor, put, you know, draw, come to anchor, shoot, and that was it. And then you hit a level and then it unravels. Or it did for me anyway. And I think, you know, the simpler the better. Martin was saying, you know, I just need to keep it simple. There's a couple of things.
I was impressed by when he said, you know, he didn't, all his things like stance, grip, all that, they weren't part of his internally spoken process.
Yeah.
Most of that is already such a learned thing, but he does similar to what I do. It sounded like where he had three or four things that his brain was looking for every time that he's either saying inside of his head or whatever. And that really, that day I was talking about where I was shooting with Dwayne Martin at the Triple Crown, I was as disciplined as I have ever been that day, because I thought with this pressure, you know, to shoot well with these guys, to try to get this buckle I want, you know, is going to be where I'm apt to break down. So there were several times that day, probably at least four, that I got up, I got my yardage, I crawled down my string, and I drew the bow, and I was almost to full anchor. And then I said, wait a minute, dummy, you didn't start with your first bit of your mantra. Put the bow down, do it all again.
Good,
and so I
good.
Did that. Probably four times, and I'm going to say at least three of those I shot 10 ring shots.
Cool. Excellent.
That,
brilliant.
That's the thing I was very proud of myself that day that I was able to do. It sounds easy. It's hard to have the discipline. I don't know why it is. Once you're up at a line or up at the stake, once you've drawn the bow, you feel like you're supposed to shoot the arrow.
Yeah.
There's
no obligation.
I mean, you have 2 minutes to shoot one arrow.
Yeah, there's no obligation to shoot, but I don't know if the brain feels like it's made an investment. You've put energy into this, so, you know, why don't we just shoot it? We can make a good shot out of this. We can make a sow's purse out of a pig's ear, but quite often,
mm-hmm. Yes.
it doesn't work out that way.
No, it. And I found even running the sear or a clicker, I don't count. I don't. There's not a timing in my head that's a number of seconds, but there is some sort of an internal clock where all of a sudden my instinct, there's a little impulse in my brain that says, okay, this has been too long. It should have gone by now. This has been too long. And if I am disciplined and if I'm on my game, I will then let the bow down. I have forced some through where I just, just go ahead and just power through this.
Those letdowns, they're the best shots. The letdowns are the best shots. That's where everyone says, good shot.
I shot, I think it was a Delaware State Championship, not last year, but the year before, and I shot with a couple of guys who were compound shooters. And we got to a target, I don't know, we were fairly far along in the 30 targets. We were probably at target 25. And I came up, I was at aim for a while, and then I let down. And one of the guys behind me said, here comes another 11. And I kind of turned around and looked at him. He goes, I don't know if you paid attention. He goes, but every single 11 you shot today was after you let down once.
That's awesome.
And so now I didn't take that as a negative. I took it as a positive. I tell myself now if I do need to let down, high likelihood that I'm going to shoot an X-ring on this next draw.
Is that because you've got yourself back into the moment and you're paying attention at that point?
I think it's like, okay, my mind has wandered away from what works. I've put the bow down now. So, okay, I took all the pressure off my brain. Now let's do your mantra, do your thing again. Your brain just wants to hear three steps. That's all it wants to hear. And that's the other thing which I find great about that mantra, that three steps is, it's the same no matter the target, the range, or the circumstance. People watching, people not watching, if it's a long, difficult shot, short shot, what have you. I can focus on the mantra and not on how hard the shot is. And that's like almost like this little hiding place for your ego. Oh, all I have to do is just stay in this little spot, do these three things, you'll be fine. And for me, at least the last year and a half, has worked pretty well.
What effect does, so you're shooting with, say you're in a final, you've got JD3, you've got Mark Lind, you've got Dwayne Martin. You're kind of in the mix or in front. How do you cope at that point? How does that pressure manifest itself, and how does the triggered shot get you through that, and the mantra, how does it kind of get away from those distractions?
It's it does give you something definite to focus on, and just the simple three things. I didn't do a very good job of it when I shot at Trad Worlds with John Demmer on the second day, because I knew I had a 10-point lead starting on Sunday. We started off, they do something called a shotgun start where you go out to say target 11 or something, and so everybody's at a target and then they sound a horn or fire a shot and everybody knows that, okay, we're going to start. That one, I didn't lose my cool or not, or shoot terribly, but I got caught sort of in the trying to shoot, really trying to shoot a score, because I was watching John just tear it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, even, I mean, John and I are friends. He put his hand on my shoulder, probably 10 targets in, and he says, "Come on, buddy, I don't want you to just go away." Which is, John's good at a little needle, you know, too, but he and I know each other well enough that he can do something like that. But I didn't take it poorly. I thought, look, I knew that I needed to pick it up. I'm shooting eights to his 11s, and that doesn't last long. 10-point lead doesn't last long that way. So that day, probably until late in the round, I really sort of gathered myself later in the round, and I shot, you know, a decent score, but not what I'd shot the previous day. But the other couple of times shooting with Dwayne and Joe Fleener and those guys, I really was able to focus. And you've probably experienced this in archery. You almost have to cheat. Your brain almost has to be taught things over and over again, like confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
And those, for me, it probably shouldn't be that way, but those first few arrows or first few targets of the day really can set my confidence high, or it could leave me a little doubting. And shooting with the guys that are right up there and coming out of the gate and sticking to my process and my mantra and having it work, putting an arrow, shooting a very controlled shot and having either hitting a 10 ring or close, but a good shot sort of settles me in for the day. And these can be like Dwayne Martin, holy smoke, that guy's won everything you can win in 3D. He was the first guy to win Vegas with a recurve since 1974.
Yeah.
He shot 280 something three straight days in a row. Once I learned that I could shoot with somebody of his caliber and compete and even win, then that does a lot for the confidence, and your brain starts to believe your mantra a little bit more.
Yeah. And that's building a self-image. Again, I'm kind of reading, I've read it and reread it a number of times. Lanny Basham's.
Oh, right. Yeah. His is a very sort of a, I won't say complicated, but very detailed book on exactly what he thinks that you need to do.
Yeah. I think for archery, there's maybe a few too many steps in there.
I thought maybe a few too many myself when I read it.
But I mean, that's personal preference. Some people can probably deal with it. Yeah, I mean, kind of, you've got to build that kind of self-image, and it has to. Everything has to be in balance. You know, your conscious skill, your subconscious skill, and your self-image. And on those days, it's like you can't miss. If everything's in balance on those days, you know, if you're not taking home a trophy, there's something wrong.
That was that second day at Snowshoe at Worlds this year. One other thing you were asking me about mantra or whatever. When I used to play a lot of golf, I started reading books by a guy who's the first sports psychologist that I knew of. He didn't invent it, but a guy named Bob Rotella.
Okay.
And he works with PGA Tour pros. He works with LeBron James. He works with all sorts. Now he is an extremely well-known, high-priced sports psychologist. But he talks about, in golf, having a pre-shot routine that doesn't vary.
Yeah.
And there's always a first step to it, which is your mental cue that gets your brain in that moment. And he talks about some people need they tap the club head on the ground two or three times, or they take the Velcro on the back of the glove and undo it and redo it or something. And it's either an audible or a felt or a visual cue to their brain that now it's time to get in this shot process.
It's like everything a little ritual, almost,
yes,
that you have
it is
to
a
do.
Ritual.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I found when I played golf that trying to put his ideas into practice were really valuable. You know, I was never I'm never going to win a world championship at any sort of golf, but so after I had been doing the mantra thing for a while, I said, oh. When I do that little step, the controlled process shooting, to me, that's the cue to my brain that, okay, now we're in this process. And there's only three steps to it. And that's all you have to worry about. You don't have to worry about wind. You don't have to worry about terrain. You don't have to worry about how far away the target is. That's already all been done. Do your three steps. So.
Good, good. I mean, I've got, it's funny you should say that. One of the guests that I've got lined up is a, he's a mindset coach. So he does sports performance.
I'll be interested to hear that.
Yeah, and he's purely concerned with mindset, and he works with top sportsmen, professional sportsmen in all genres of sport. And he's got some people through some pretty tough times to where they've become, I mean, they've been down in the depths. I mean, this is like target panic on steroids. And not necessarily to do with the game that they're involved. It was something that they did in their game which caused them to be banned for a time. And they got a lot of negative publicity, and they were kind of out of the sport, as it were. But the player himself realized that he needed to do something to get back, and it wasn't a physical thing. He could go out, practice that. He could go and practice that in the park, but it was the mental side that he needed help with. So this guy helped him through that, and he ended up becoming, you know, a world beater again. You know, kind of phoenix rising from the ashes. You know, from a very bad situation, completely of his own kind of creation, but understanding what he needed to get back, how humble he was when he came back, and then kind of doing the job and performing when the pressure was really, really on. So that's going to be, I've not got that long with him, but that's going to be interesting. So I need to do a bit of research for that. But,
yeah, he's probably in demand.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Yeah, quite a bit. He's like Bob Rotella. He has a high price tag normally, so.
Yeah, I we've not discussed money.
No, don't do that.
No,
don't ask if he doesn't mention it.
Yeah, let's not go there.
No, I agree.
I mean, who do you credit with? You know, you've said you've had 23 years or more, or you know, you've had a long time with dealing with target panic, and you found various ways around it. And the grips here and your mantra is what you're doing now. And it obviously, by the results, it's working for you. Who kind of do you credit with getting through at the start with target panic and then later on?
At the very start, when I figured out I had it and I'd never heard of target panic in my life, was I used to shoot pistols at an indoor gun range that was not too far from my house. And I'd been around firearms as a kid, and I had a pretty steady hand, and I was pretty good at it. I was a good shooter in this pistol league. Well, there was a fellow that was shooting in the pistol league with me, and he was an archer. He was actually a very good, regular Olympic type recurve archer. And he'd won a lot of Maryland state championships. And he just asked me, he said, do you have a bow? You ever shoot? Are you as good with your bow as you are with a pistol? I said, I wouldn't say that, but I've shot a bow off and on for years. So he said, why don't you come by? And he invited me to an indoor league night. And I still shot my compound with fingers, and I hadn't even probably shot it in, I don't know, a couple of years. And I went to that indoor league night and shooting with, you know, sight pins, but just with finger release. I missed the whole backstop two or three times. Like that shock, surprise, what happened?
Oh, dear.
And there went the arrow. And that's, you know, hugely embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so I went outside and I tried to shoot it a few more times. And then I discovered if the pin got close to the gold, the arrow just left. And because I played a lot of golf and I shot pistols and things, I just put the bow away for several years. And then I tried a compound with actually a trigger finger release, just like a hunting bow, just to play around with. And because it was a compound with peep sight and all that, even though I was probably kind of smacking the trigger or punching it, as they'd say, I could shoot it decently. But then I really wanted to, I said to myself, well, I bet all this is only a compound thing because there's sights. If I pick up my recurve bow, I'll be fine. I picked it up and I couldn't draw to my face, you know. And then the first, your question, who do you credit? I credit my friend Ron Broadwater and Glenn Latubnikus, the first two guys I met at Baltimore Bowman, was showing me how to put a clicker on my bow and how to do that. Because I went from a guy that couldn't hit a 3D target. I mean, you know, I'm short drawing by 3 inches and then just letting go. To within a year or so, I didn't say it, but the guys in my club were saying I was probably the best 3D shooter in my club. Because it allowed me to aim wherever I wanted to aim and then do the process of pulling through the clicker and shoot. So I did a lot of training myself with that clicker, and I found things that I thought worked better, like don't focus on the click, focus on the follow-through. And when I focus on the follow-through, if I had a beautiful follow-through, it was a beautiful shot almost every time. So did that for a lot of years. And then I've read, maybe like you have or some of your the people listening, I've read, so if I was reading a forum on the internet and it started target panic and a program, I read it and I tried it. So over those years, I tried a lot of things. But once I read some things that Joel had written, I saw some videos that Joel did, I started trying to implement those ideas. And even when I was trying the feather touch to my nose, then I'd gotten Joel's number and talked to him. And he's a very generous guy. He's willing to talk, as you probably know.
Yeah, I've spoken to him a couple of times.
I was like, well, why doesn't this work quite like a clicker for me? He said, well, the clicker is a real hard slap in the face to your brain. You can't mistake it. He said, feather touch to your nose will work just as well, but it's much more subtle. And, you know, the other phrase he says is, it won't work for you. You have to work for it. And I found that to really be true with trying any sort of a sear system.
Yeah, that's where I am.
Because now I can actually draw, my draw length could be wherever I want it to be. It's not a draw check at all. And if all of a sudden I doubt that it's going to work and I don't believe it's going to work, it won't work.
Yeah.
That's the key. And I think a little bit like what Martin said, you know, I was intrigued to hear him say that people had used trigger type systems even in the early 90s to win medals and European championships. I said, you know, Joel didn't invent that, but Joel gave people a blueprint for how to use it.
Yeah.
I'm sure
yeah.
the guys that won with it back in the 90s had their own blueprint. They did something that worked. But the one thing, you know, I've listened to a lot of Joel's things, and he talks about we brace for impact and we can't cause an action like that as a surprise. Well, I never had a problem with a firearm. I could shoot, you know, like a 45 automatic pistol with a very light trigger with absolutely no flinch before the shot and do it repeatedly. But something about the idea that you're letting the arrow go and you're holding it back and there's this pressure on your fingers, you're letting it go, seems way more, it's something that you just anticipate.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a decision I've got to make at the minute. I'm kind of struggling through. I know I need to make a decision. I'm not at your level, JD3's level. I'm a club archer. So
I'm not at Grayson Partlow or JD3's level either. But the other thing that allows me to have been successful at unknown yardage 3D like IBO is I am a very good judge of yardage. I don't know why.
How do you do it? What's your kind of method?
I do work on it, and I try to shoot a lot of practice shots at 20 yards, 23 yards, 25 yards, 27 yards, and 30 yards. And I've got different marks for all of those.
Is that into a 3D target, or is that just a target boss?
3D target. Yeah, I find that looking at a backstop or a boss is not the same for me to try to figure the yardage out of it. It is kind of, but it's not like a full-size Reinhardt 3D deer, like a buck. It's universal. You see it a lot. It's you shoot it a lot at IBO. If your brain can get used to what that looks like at 20 yards and 15 yards and 30 yards or whatever. But really, my keys are if I can pretty accurately see 20 yards, 25 yards, and 30 yards, I can shoot well. And I actually take, when I practice, I take a rangefinder with me. I don't do this every practice session, but I do it once in a while. I will step up to a yardage. I'll look at it. I'll say in my brain, all right, that looks like 25 yards to me. And I'll look at it for a while, especially if it's a tournament, I would. But really look at it like, do you really think it's 25 yards? Yep, I do. Then I go to my 25 mark. I shoot my shot. And then after I shoot the arrow, I range it. And especially if I've hit high or low, that kind of really makes it sink into your brain. Like if I made a mistake on the yardage, then I'll stand at the stake and I'm like, why was I wrong on that? And that helps it sort of sink into me. But I will sometimes, I'll stop at a convenience store and get out of my car and I'll say, how far is it from here to that trash can? I'll say, well, it looks like 19 yards to me, and I'll pace it. And I'm almost always within a yard. Every once in a while, you have days where you're not on. But for one reason or another, I'm pretty good at judging yardage. And that, to me, is an equalizer in 3D.
Yeah.
There, I think, are plenty of people that are technically better archers than I am. But if we're on an unknown yardage 3D course, I can make up ground on them, or I can maybe stay even with them.
Do you also get a kind of library of sight pictures for the various targets, do you think? That you kind of go, your brain kind of recognizes a Reinhardt particular target at a distance because you've shot it quite a few times, and then you see it at a different distance and you go, that looks, and your brain automatically processes it because it has kind of a library of target pictures to look
maybe.
Into.
Do you mean like when I'm at full draw and aiming, or do you mean just generally looking at it?
Just ranging, or when you get up there as well.
I think exactly what you said is really kind of what happens to me. I've seen certain targets, and I've been fooled over the years on certain targets that, you know, for one reason or another, the fallow deer, which is spotted deer, or an axis deer, that target in a Reinhardt, to me, looks closer than it is. I've missed, at 2017 Worlds, I actually missed under the belly of one of those. I was 4 yards off on distance, and that's what encouraged me to figure out a faster arrow. I was shooting about 170 feet per second back then. Now I'm shooting about 210, just because I shoot a lot lighter arrow now.
What arrow?
Yep. I shoot the Victory Vap 600 spine arrow with an 80 grain glue in point, and I shoot the XS wings. It's like a plastic vane that's kind of a hook to it. They're fragile, but they are the lightest vane I've found. I always shot feathers. But if you're shooting in an outdoor tournament and it's raining and there's no lightning, you're still going to have to shoot. And
yeah.
A lot of people put bags over their feathers.
Been there.
And that works. Yeah, that works, bags over your feathers. But you have to be very disciplined on rotating an arrow and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, we had a shoot here where it was kind of gusting 50-mile-an-hour winds. The rain was horizontal. I've never been that wet. It was a
It was a
case of, like, you know, at the kind of admin stroke kind of food stop halfway round a course. It was take all of the gear that you've got, including all of your waterproofs off, stick them in a bag, get a completely new outfit. The scorecards just disintegrated. That wet. I mean, we had scorecards in plastic bags, inside Gore-Tex jackets, but you get the scorecard out and just, you know, 20 seconds of trying to score, the scorecard was gone. I mean, thankfully you've got multiple scorecards, but I learned a valuable lesson that I tried. Was it the Bunning, the kind of dust that you put on to waterproof it? I had a plastic bag. I was trying to rotate. Oh man, they were just like, they looked like, you know, kind of a shaggy dog, a sad shaggy dog on a very rainy, wet day, just stuck to the body. It doesn't look the same. And I was like, I'm practically just shooting bear shafts here. So yeah, learn that lesson.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of equipment and preparation, what riser, what limbs, string? You've just explained the arrows. You've gone up to a faster arrow to cut down.
Yeah, the only rest of that arrow is I draw about 28 inches, and to get that arrow to tune correctly, it's cut at about 28 1/8 inches from the nock groove to the end of the carbon.
Okay.
So it's light. It only weighs 249 grains.
Wow, that's light. Mine are about 270, something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty light. So that was a giant jump forward from what I used to shoot as far as speed. I use a Win & Win AL1 riser. It's a riser they probably quit making 3 years ago.
Okay.
I bought it used off a guy at my club that shot Olympic recurve. I've always liked it. I like the grip on it. It fits my hand well. And I also in time, found out that I could run that grip sear off the front of that riser perfectly. So the riser is the last thing I look at ever wanting to shop for, because that one works so well. Last year I got a new set of limbs from John Wirt at Lancaster when he was still there. He let me test. I used to go to his office and we could test limbs, and I tested some Win & Win Wiewis NS. They're the carbon foam limbs. They're 36 pound longs. They give me actually at my draw, I'm not bottomed out on my limb bolts. I'm about 1.5 revolutions out, but at my draw, they give me about 39 pounds.
You're string walking, I presume, or fixed?
I am string walking, yeah. Right. I shoot zero tiller or an even tiller.
Okay.
I find that works for me pretty well. I use last year was the first time I had gotten consistent strings from somebody that really made good strings. I got 60X, a company in Pennsylvania, makes excellent strings. I ordered, and they make them. I'm amazed how fast they can turn them around. I ordered strings of a particular color on a day, and 2 days later I had them at my place.
Yeah, that's good service.
And it's an 8125G is the material. And it's 18 strands. And then I like a pretty good, I like the knock to fit on with a nice little click on the string. Not real hard, but I want it definitely to click on. String walking, I don't want any maybes. You know, I don't want the arrow to fall off. So I usually take, I like 60X strings fit pretty well, but I usually reserve it with a 0.026. Angel Majesty serving, and that gives me the knock fit I want. And then I just tie a top and bottom knock set, which is PCY, you know, knock tie string.
What's your kind of process just for kind of heading into a competition, a few weeks running up to it, maybe a month, 6 weeks running up to it? What kind of things are you doing there? How are you? Your training, is it just all arrows, distance judging, or do you have other things that you do? Do you blank boss? Do you just work on bits of your shot? What specifically do you do?
That's a good question. Last year, I really tried to do similar things throughout the year for 3D. I tried to get out there as much as I could, even if it was only for 30 minutes, to shoot at some 3D targets during the week, you know, get home from work and go shoot. I would pick out among our targets that are still out in the woods at Baltimore Bowman, I would only shoot at the ones that had real scoring rings on them. I would try to go, you know, I would try to shoot anywhere from 10 to 30 targets in a day, and I would actually score them. I would do it most of the time just like I was actually shooting, and I have a little app on my phone called Tournament 3D Archery, and it allows you to look at all your shots in order. It tells you what you shot and what your average is. And then sometimes I'll pick a yardage that or a particular target that I've had that's maybe given me some trouble, And I will stand there and shoot groups at that target. I want to convince my brain that I can hit 10 rings at will at whatever that yardage is on that target. And for me, for whatever reason, we have one of these. It's a Reinhardt fighting buck. He's kind of got his head down and twisted a little bit like he would be locked up with another deer. I don't know why, but if I'm going to shoot a bad shot, it seems like it's on him. That and the other target is a some people call it a badger, but it's a wolverine.
Okay.
Which is a fierce little animal that lives in the United States. But it's the kill zone's about the same size as the javelina. But that target seems to give people some trouble, and it gave me trouble. And so I'd stand out there and really try to wear that one out too. Just like, I'm going to convince my brain that that I mentally own this target.
Yeah. I've got a target. It's the kind of lying deer.
Bedded. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The bedded deer. I always shoot over the back for some reason. That's a target that I need to kind of buy, stick it in the field, and then just practice mm-hmm. with it, just because
I agree.
My brain sees it, and I always think, I don't know if my brain thinks, I'm going to shoot into the ground here. Let's just give it a little bit more, and it always just sails an inch over its back, and you're kind of like, oh. But
that's interesting, because the bedded deer used to be my nemesis target, but I always shot low.
Oh, right. So you went the opposite way.
And so what I started doing, and I don't do it now, but there for about a year or so, as I would get to a bedded deer target, I would look at it and I would say, well, that looks to be 23 yards. And then I would say, add 2 yards, shoot it for 25. And that seemed to help. And I shot enough good shots on bedded deer that now I can treat it like any other target.
Just finally, because we've been on now for nearly an hour and a half, it's flown by. Doesn't feel like it's that long.
People that know me know I kind of like to talk, so I'm sorry.
Oh no, you know, you're a brilliant talker. It's been fascinating. If someone's gonna take up 3D, if they're a field shooter, it's not that much of a transition, but if they're a target shooter and they're used to standing on a nice flat field shooting at 50 meters or 70 meters, or you know, they just do indoor leagues. What kind of advice would you give them? This is where you need to head. These are the kind of people you need to be looking at, including yourself, because you've done remarkably well over the last 2-3 years. Where should they go? What should they do? What kind of advice should they seek out?
Well, I think, I'll tell you, for me, I think a leap forward happened when I went to a big IBO shoot. Like I said, I qualified at the Pennsylvania shoot, but I went to the IBO Worlds, and there's this starstruck, okay, I not only see John Denver, but he's standing here talking to me. And then you're going around and he's just one of the guys shooting. That has a good effect, but most of the time, at least here in the United States, I'd say 95% of the people that you shoot with that are good shooters, they'll give you some advice. Maybe they don't do it during the course of the round. Maybe they do. It depends. A lot of times they don't want to mess you up at what you're doing during the round. But you get with them, you sit down at the picnic table, and you can pick their brain. You know, Dwayne Martin, once I met him and I got his phone number, I'll text him once in a while and I ask him how he approaches certain things, and I'll ask people about arrow speeds and a whole myriad of things like we've talked about. And 95% of these guys are very willing to share what they know, and they'll even tell you, well, here's what I'm working on, because here's the thing that I'm not good at. And you start to realize that even people that have accomplished a lot will share things with you that, you know, they're still not solid on. And it kind of gives you a comfort zone of, yeah, all right, it's just, you know, I went to the World Archery Trials in Kentucky last year, and Matt Potter was there, and he said, look, we're just a bunch of middle-aged fat guys shooting at foam. This is no big deal. and so comfort level is a lot of it. But I've seen this, if people have watched the push film, it's called IBO Masters.
Yeah, I've seen it several times.
You ever watch that?
Yep.
Most everyone on there recommends, if you're a new archer at something, getting with, like Dwayne says, get with an old archer. But go somewhere where these guys are shooting. And if, I mean, I don't think I'm qualified to teach anybody anything, but if I go to an IBO shoot and somebody wants to ask me something, I'll tell you what I know. I mean, maybe it's technically right, maybe it's not, but I'll definitely tell you what works for me. And most of those guys will. And equipment too, like that first year at Worlds, I learned 170 feet per second is probably not fast enough unless you are to the yard on every target.
Yeah, you've got to be bang on there, haven't you?
Yeah, so if you know, people will tell you how to get equipment that's worked for them. They'll tell you limbs that have worked for them, risers, grips, all that sort of feeds into it. But the experience of doing it, of knowing that, okay, I got through this. Boy, am I nervous, but I made it through this, is a stair step for your brain to be able to achieve. Because I know, and I still get nervous. I think everybody does the first few targets, first few arrows even of an indoor or whatever. But to learn that I could step up to the first target, and for one reason or another, I have a string of, we usually shuffle cards and people pick the cards in your group, and then whoever they pick out first is the first shooter. I have a pretty long string of being the first picked first.
Oh, dear.
So I had to get over, I won't say I got over, but I had to learn to realize I can, it's with all these guys that are, you know, archery heroes, but I can step up to the peg and go through my process and shoot a shot, and you know, nothing terrible is going to happen to me. And I learned to shoot shots like golfers will talk about hit putts with your hands shaking. I learned sometimes on those first few shots that, boy, that sight picture is real. It's not just your float. It's it's like you have a little lawnmower engine out on your bow. It's just shaking it around. But I learned to still trust the process and go through the shots and see what happens.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
That was a bit big for me to learn that you can still shoot good shots even when you're shaking. So,
well, that's all really good advice. We've got a couple of organizations here that shoot 3D. The biggest one is called NFAS, which is, it's similar to IBO. It's a one arrow 40 target course. Mm-hmm. But they can shoot anything from 5 yards up to 100 yards. They do like some really, really long shots.
That's not for the timid.
No. You just hope that they've got some kind of really good metal detector on hand.
Right. Because at 100 yards, there's not going to be a lot of hits there.
No. And they're usually fairly big targets. They're kind of elk size, but mm-hmm. still there's a lot of margin to miss there. The World Archery, through Archery GB, the World Archery 3D class has really kind of, in the last few years, really taken off. Mm-hmm. We had a national championships, which I think was the first time, which I shot in, and I got peer grouped just below the kind of top four. So I was peer grouped, was it 5, 6, 7, 8, I think, in that one.
That's great.
Well, that was my first kind of 3D shoot. That was my first competitive 3D shoot. But I had a really good start of the day, and then all it took was for someone to say to me, oh, you're shooting really well. And that was the end.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that was the end.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, game over.
Yeah.
So
that's, yeah.
That was the point at which I think the day after I rang Joel.
You rang Joel.
Yes.
He's a remarkably patient person too, because I guess he's kind of seen it all, so, or heard it all.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's a decision I've got to make. There's mm-hmm. there's one guy, he's amongst a few that have tried Joel's system. I've shot in a few competitions with him, one being the Kendall 3D Open, and another one being our local shoot. I didn't shoot with him. He took first, I took third. He took first. The guy who came second was the IFAA Barebow World Champion from, I think, 2018, 2019. Oh, 2018, oh. I think. I came behind him But the guy who took first, he fully transitioned to Gripsir, the Mantra, fully bought into Joel's system, and a couple of other guys. I've kind of steered them that way because I'd bought Joel's book, so they kind of went that way, and they were like really happy. But the guy who won it also won the local field shoot here. We have a field shoot as well, a feeta field. He took that. I took third. I was beaten to second by 1 point.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I like feeta field. It's fun.
Yeah, but that was a total meltdown day on the target bosses. I mean, it was like I couldn't miss. It was like they were just laser-guided. But I got that kind of 3 inches from the face. I just shot, either 17 or 18 on a 60 centimetre at just over 30 metres on the unmarked next target. I couldn't, the string never got anywhere near my face. All three shots missed twice. And I was like, this is, for me at the minute, it's just one shot and that's it. It's a real, something else takes over and it's really, really hard to get back. So hearing people who've had the same issue and they've got through it and they've changed their systems between, you know, a limited clicker over to Tabsir, Gripsir, but, you know, you're still performing at a high level. It kind of fills people with confidence that, and like you were saying before about you meet these other guys, they're right at the top of their game. They're people you see on, you know, YouTube, on kind of in finals and stuff like that, Lancaster Classic. And then it's good when they say, well, here's what I'm working on, because it's like the job's never done. There's always something that just needs a little bit of attention. So, yeah, it's good to hear all that.
Yeah, it's like golf. You never can say, okay, I got it. It's done. You can't. And archery's the same way. You can't say, okay, I've got it. And it's, you know, I think sometimes people perceive if I do something like a sear or whatever, that's the way I prefer to shoot. I would prefer to shoot to be able to get my crawl, aim, hold what seems like a nice long time, expand, release, and shoot. That's what I would prefer. I just can't seem to do that. So I've used different systems, and now, you know, grips here, and it accomplishes the same thing for me. So,
well,
a well-shot shot with that feels good anyway. You know, it doesn't feel mechanical.
Yeah. Well, Dwight, I'm not going to hold you any longer because it's been brilliant, and we're getting up for nearly an hour and 40 minutes. It doesn't seem that long, but the time's flown by. I'm going to give you the rest of your day back.
Thank you. I just appreciate, you know, you wanting to talk with me. This is the first podcast of any sort that I've been on, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm glad kind of Corey and other people have kind of pointed you in my direction with the podcast. It's been great, the support. I mean, we're only 3 episodes in. This would be the 3rd. I've asked a lot of people kind of because I thought it was going to be difficult to get people. I thought people would say, ah, I'm busy, I've got this big tournament coming up, I've got all this practice. And you know what? The truth about Barebow and how open and accommodating, friendly, helpful people are, it absolutely does ring true. I mean, I contacted several people and they just said, yep, I'm fine whenever, I'm available on these days. Not available on these days, but, you know, we're trying to work the schedule around and get people in. But I did want to speak to someone who kind of keyed in on 3D and had, you know, gone through kind of using limited clicker and Gripsir, just to say to people, look, you know, you want to shoot this, learn how to shoot, you know, foam, learn how to shoot unmarked yardage. And if you do have problems, there are ways out.
Well, I hope that if people are having problems and, you know, be they a 3D shooter or anything else, if the other traditional systems aren't working for them, maybe something they heard me say maybe helps a little bit or points them in a direction, that would be great.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. We're doing it for the community. And for me, it's kind of people help me out, you know, right from the start. People have encouraged me. and, you know, I've had a bit of a support system there. So it's just kind of putting back. So thank you very much for taking part.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you so much. And I look forward to listening to, you know, more of your podcast. That's great. I like listening to Matt and the guys on The Push. And
oh, yeah.
And you as well.
They got me started. So big shout out to them. They got me started. I was shooting Olympic Recurve and I was kind of disillusioned with it. And I stumbled across their film on YouTube. And their, I think I commented to Matt the other day, if his podcasts were VHS tapes, they'd just be static on there. I've listened to them so many times. I've worn them out.
I think I saw that on Facebook, maybe.
Yeah. I've literally worn them out. So, yeah, and they're still coming. So that's good. I've got a few of the kind of coaching ones and the ones with Tim Johnson and what was the other one I was listening to? John Dillinger as well.
I was there at Lancaster when he won Lancaster, and it was great to see.
Yeah.
The year before John Dillinger beat me, I made it to the eliminations. It was the first round of eliminations at Lancaster, and then I got to face him. I said, "Oh, great! I get Godzilla," and he was very gracious and a very nice guy. I didn't know him until that point, but a very nice guy. And I think he beat me by 10 points on 12 arrows, but very nice guy. So, but I was glad to see him, you know, break through.
Yeah,
that was great.
Yeah. Well, we look forward. There's still a few more competitions left on the indoors, so we look forward to seeing what's going on there, and then we're all outdoors again, and we can shoot at some big foam animals or some big foam bosses, and kind of get another landmark in our archery career. Hopefully, by then, I will have made a decision about where I'm going to go.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, hope to maybe someday be at a shoot where you are and get to shoot with you. That would be great.
Yeah. Excellent. Nice talking to you. Thank you very much, Dwight.
Nice to talk with you, Glenn. Oh, absolutely. You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thanks, Dwight. I really enjoyed that chat. Lots to take away from that, and a few things that I might need to consider. As I said in the intro, we've got more guests lined up, delving into the mindset, sports performance, performance management, and having a shop blueprint. Remember, you can contact us on email, the Barebow Archery Podcast. That's all one word. @gmail.com, or we have a page on Facebook. Just search for Barebow Archery Podcast. Thanks for listening. Until next time, see you later.
Produced and presented by Glenn Pringle for Redstone Productions Limited.
This is the Barebow Archery Podcast.